In the hot light of a 5th century afternoon, the road leading into Elea is dusty and rutted. A small crowd has gathered at the edge of the agora, men in worn tunics, boys who should be running errands, a few visiting merchants resting their packs. At the center stands a tall, lean man with sharp features and an intensity that makes even idle listeners a little uneasy. He is not offering a prophecy, nor telling stories of gods and heroes, nor selling cures. He is asking questions about motion, about plurality, about the most ordinary things in the world. How does a runner catch a slower competitor? How does an arrow move through the air? How can a body reach a destination if it must always first get halfway there, and before that, halfway to the halfway, and so on without end? The man is Zeno of Elea, and in the space of a few sentences, he will make the familiar seem impossible. Zeno is remembered almost entirely for his paradoxes. We know little about his life compared to his intellectual footprint. He was born in Elea, a Greek colony on the southern coast of Italy, probably around 490 BCE. Elea itself, like Miletus before it, was an unlikely seedbed of philosophy, a modest city far from Athens, populated by colonists and traders, perched between the Greek and Italic worlds. Yet in the early 5th century, it became home to one of the most audacious movements in early thought, the Eleatic school, associated above all with Parmenides. Zeno is described in later sources as Parmenides' pupil, perhaps even his adopted son, and as his intellectual defender, where Parmenides composed a dense poem arguing that reality is one, ungenerated, unchanging, and undivided. Zeno took on a different role. The architect of puzzles designed to show that his master's critics would run into worse absurdities than the ones they mocked. Plato, writing a century later, portrays Zeno as arriving in Athens with Parmenides, bringing with him a book of arguments that astonished the young Socrates. The drama may be embellished, but the characterization is apt. Zeno's writings were likely in prose, organized as a series of demonstrations. According to reports, he wrote 40 or so arguments, most of them aimed at showing that if you assume plurality and motion to be real in the way common sense assumes, you will be driven to contradictions. Only a handful of these survive in detail, a few famous arguments about motion, some about divisibility and plurality. But those few have been enough to keep philosophers, mathematicians, and physicists busy for 2.5 millennia. Consider the most famous of them. Often called the race between Achilles and the tortoise, the setting is simple. A swift runner, Achilles, gives a tortoise a head start in a foot race. Common sense says Achilles will easily overtake it. Zeno asks us to think more carefully. To catch the tortoise, Achilles must first reach the point where the tortoise began. By the time he arrives there, the tortoise, being slower, has moved a little further on. Achilles must now reach this new point. When he does, the tortoise has again moved on, though by a smaller distance. Achilles closes that gap, but again the tortoise is a bit ahead. So there is an infinite sequence of positions Achilles must reach, where the tortoise has just been. At each stage, Achilles does indeed get closer, but there is always another small distance to run. How, Zeno asks, can he ever complete an infinite number of tasks in a finite time? If he cannot, then it seems he will never overtake the tortoise. The conclusion directly contradicts common sense. Either our notion of motion is incoherent, or there is something wrong with our confidence that time and space can be carved into endlessly smaller parts. In another argument, Zeno imagines a runner trying simply to reach a finish line. Before reaching the end, the runner must reach the halfway point. Before that, the halfway to the halfway, and so on without limit. The distance between starting point and finish is finite. But the number of intervals you can conceptually divide it into is infinite. To traverse the whole, the runner must traverse all these sub-intervals. But how can one ever finish moving through an infinity of places? If each subdistance takes some time, however small, then the total time should be infinite. If, on the other hand, Some of these steps take no time at all. What sense does it make to speak of them as genuine steps? The bare intuition that a finite stretch of space can contain an infinite number of smaller segments collides with the intuition that completing infinitely many tasks cannot be done in finite time. Then there is the image of the arrow in flight. At any single instant, Zeno says, the arrow occupies a space exactly equal to itself. At that instant, it is not moving to the left or to the right. It is simply where it is. If time is composed of such instants, each of which finds the arrow at rest, and if motion is nothing more than the sum of these instants, then motion seems to dissolve into a sequence of motionless positions. How can it be that from nothing but a series of is here now, is here now, is here now, we ever get genuine motion? Again, the way we ordinarily imagine time, as a line made up of points, comes under pressure. If time is all instants and no duration, then nothing can ever happen in it. If there is duration, then perhaps the notion of an instant is not as straightforward as it appears. In another paradox, sometimes called the stadium or the moving rose, Zeno imagines bodies moving past one another, and tries to show that the combination of their motions yields contradictory measurements of time. The details in the surviving reports are murky, but the thrust is similar. If you assume space and time are divisible in the way we naively think, you wind up with incompatible accounts of how long and how far. It is important to see that Zeno is not, as a superficial reading might suggest, some kind of sophist playing games for the sake of intellectual showmanship. His paradoxes were meant as a kind of counterattack. Parmenides had argued that change and plurality are illusory at the deepest level of reality, and his contemporaries often mocked this as absurd. To claim that all is one and that motion is unreal seemed to fly in the face of obvious experience. Zeno's book, if we believe the ancient stories, was written to show that the alternatives to Eleatic monism, the common sense notion that there are many things and that they move, lead to paradoxes at least as bad as those Parmenides was accused of. If you laugh at the idea that motion is impossible, Zeno effectively says, try giving a coherent account of how motion is possible. Your own picture, once examined, will crack. In this sense, Zeno is a negative logician. He does not develop a positive picture of what the one is. That work had been done by Parmenides. Zeno instead dismantles the assumptions that support a belief in a world of many shifting things. If you say there are many things, he has arguments ready to show that they must be both infinitely large and infinitely small, both limited and unlimited. If you say motion is real, he presents cases where motion becomes impossible as soon as you analyze it too precisely. If you say space and time are composed of indivisible atoms, other problems arise. If you say they are infinitely divisible, you fall back into Achilles and the tortoise. From the standpoint of the history of philosophy, this matters in two ways. First, Zeno's paradoxes force later thinkers to clarify their basic concepts of space, time, continuity, and infinity. The ancient Greeks did not yet have the tools of calculus or set theory, but they already had to face the problem of how a finite whole can contain an infinity of parts, and how infinite divisibility can coexist with finite magnitude. Every serious theory of motion and extension, from Aristotle's physics through medieval scholastic discussions to early modern mechanics and finally to modern mathematical analysis, can be read as, among other things, a series of attempts to answer Zeno. Second, Zeno illustrates an early form of what will later be called the method of reductio ad absurdum. You assume what your opponent assumes, show that it leads to contradiction, and conclude that the assumption must be rejected. The method itself was known before him, but he applied it with unusual purity. Let there be many things, he says in effect, or let there be motion. And then he follows this through logically until it yields consequences no one can accept. In that sense, he is not only a defender of Parmenides, but a technician in the uses of rigorous argument. To see more clearly how his paradoxes work, we have to enter, for a moment, into the intellectual world of his time. The Greeks were just beginning to think explicitly in geometrical and arithmetical terms about magnitudes. They knew, for example, that a line segment could be cut in half, and that half again, as often as one liked, in thought if not in practice. They understood, in embryo, the idea of infinite divisibility. At the same time, they did not have a firm way of distinguishing between a potential infinity, you can go on dividing without ever finishing, and an actual infinity, a completed set of infinitely many items. Zeno's paradoxes hinge on that ambiguity. Achilles seems to have to complete an actually infinite number of tasks. The runner seems to have to cover an actually infinite number of subintervals. The arrow seems to occupy an actually infinite number of instants. From a modern mathematical point of view, we might say that Achilles covers a distance represented by a convergent series, the sum of 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8, and so on, which adds up to 1. The fact that there are infinitely many terms does not prevent the total from being finite. Achilles does not have to perform infinitely many tasks in the sense of a countable sequence of discrete actions. His continuous motion simply instantiates the whole process at once. But to Zeno's contemporaries, such a response was not available in the same formal way. The paradox forced them to reckon with what it means to complete a process that admits of endless subdivision. Aristotle, later, will offer what many take to be the classical ancient response. He insists that while a line is divisible without end, the infinite exists only potentially, not actually. We can divide as much as we like, but there is no completed infinite collection of segments. Similarly, time can be thought of as divisible into ever smaller intervals, but no one needs to live through an actually infinite number of instants to traverse a finite span. Motion is continuous, not a sequence of stops and starts. The arrow moves not by jumping from rest point to rest point, but by existing in different places at different times in a way that is not analyzable into static instants. This Aristotelian move does not silence Zeno. Modern philosophers still debate whether it really resolves the tension. But it shows how fruitful his puzzles were. They forced deeper reflection on continuity and infinity than would otherwise have been needed. For Zeno himself, the point was not to lay the foundations of calculus, but to corner his opponents. If you think there are many things located in space and time, you must either admit infinite divisibility or deny it. If you admit it, you open yourself to Achilles and the runner. If you deny it and posit indivisible atoms of space and time, new paradoxes emerge about how motion can occur without leaping over gaps. Either way, the Eleatic position that the one, which is not in space and not in time as we understand them, is the only true reality, begins to look less ridiculous. It may violate the senses, but at least it does not fall into these puzzles. In the more concrete political and cultural world, Zeno's reputation also had another dimension. Later anecdotes describe him as bold, even reckless, in confronting tyranny. One story has him plotting against a local tyrant, being captured, and biting off his own tongue rather than naming his co-conspirators. Another tells that he hurled insults at the tyrant, even under torture, goading him into killing him and thereby freeing the city. These tales may be embellished, but they correspond to a pattern. The Eleatics were not purely abstract thinkers. Parmenides, too, is said to have been a lawgiver. The same insistence on consistency and unity that shapes their metaphysics seems to have found a political echo in a hatred of arbitrary rule. For a series on moral philosophy, this convergence matters. Zeno's paradoxes may not look, at first glance, like moral arguments. They do not tell us how to live. They do, however, model a kind of intellectual courage and rigor that will become part of the philosopher's ethical ideal. He is willing to push an argument to its extreme, to accept conclusions that jar with everyday perception, and to expose the comfortable assumptions of his opponents as fragile. That attitude, turned inward, becomes a moral stance, a refusal to accept unexamined beliefs just because they are widespread, a readiness to trace the consequences of one's own views, even if they unsettle one's sense of the world. There is also, embedded in his work, a lesson about humility. Zeno shows that common sense notions of motion, space, and time are not as transparent as we might think. If such basic features of our experience can generate paradox under analysis, what about our more complex moral judgments? If we can be mistaken, or at least conceptually confused, about something as apparently straightforward as a runner overtaking a tortoise, perhaps we should be cautious in our confidence about justice, happiness, or virtue. Here, the purely logical puzzles become a parable about the limits of intuitive thinking. At the same time, Zeno demonstrates that the search for clarity is not a luxury but a necessity if we want to avoid hidden contradictions. To live well, on many later accounts, means to live in a way that is coherent, that does not tear us apart internally. Zeno's practice and argument mirrors that aspiration. He probes for inconsistency, for places where what we say in one breath contradicts what we say in another. In ethics, a similar probing reveals when our professed values clash with our actual choices, or when our ideals cannot be reconciled with our institutions. The Eleatic method, translated into moral terms, would ask, can you really hold all these beliefs together without absurdity? In the long arc of philosophical history, Zeno of Elea becomes a touchstone whenever questions of infinity and continuity arise. Medieval thinkers reading him through Aristotle debate whether the world can have a beginning in time or must be eternal, and whether an infinite regress of causes is possible. Early modern philosophers revisit his paradoxes when they argue about absolute space and time. In the 20th century, the development of rigorous analysis, measure theory, and topology can be seen, in part, as providing the tools that Zeno's puzzles had demanded for so long. Even contemporary discussions in physics about the granularity of space-time, Planck lengths, and quantum discreteness echo his concerns. If space and time are ultimately discrete, how does motion work? If they are continuous, how do we reconcile that with quantum phenomena? Zeno, of course, could not have foreseen any of this. He stood in a small city, composing arguments in an intellectual environment that had barely begun to formalize mathematics. Yet his insistence on pushing intuitions about space and time to their breaking points anticipated the need for better tools. He did not have the solutions, but he knew where the problems lay. When you introduce Zeno in your series, you can invite listeners to feel both the charm and the threat of his thought. The charm lies in the simplicity of the scenarios: a race, a runner, an arrow, a moving row of bodies. These are things anyone can picture. The threat lies in what happens when you slow them down conceptually. The ordinary world begins to fray. That fraying is not a sign that the world itself is unreal, but it is a sign that the way we initially think about it may be inadequate. There is a moment every child has, or could have, when a simple puzzle suddenly opens up into a sense of wonder or disorientation. Zeno's paradoxes, at their best, recreate that moment for adults. They ask us to suspend the easy answer, to let the difficulty bite. Achilles, of course, overtakes the tortoise. We have seen races. But how exactly do we understand this fact in light of infinite divisibility? An arrow, of course, flies. We have shot arrows, or at least watched projectiles move. But what is motion if at each instant the object is where it is and nowhere else? The temptation is to shrug and say the paradox is silly. Zeno's challenge is to resist that shrug. We do not know how Zeno's own life ended with certainty, nor how much of his work was read in his own lifetime. We do know that later philosophers treated him with respect even when they criticized him. Aristotle devoted careful attention to his arguments. Plato gave him a cameo in a dialogue. Commentators through late antiquity quoted him as a serious interlocutor. His paradoxes survived not as curiosities, but as problems to be solved or at least dissolved. For someone tracing the genealogy of philosophical styles, Zeno matters because he shows a new way of arguing. Not by appealing to authority or tradition, not by telling a more compelling story, but by constructing a situation in which our own assumptions tear themselves apart. It is an aggressive, almost surgical technique. It clears space. In that cleared space, new structures of thought become possible. The ideas of atomists, of Aristotelian physics, of later mathematical theories of the continuum, all occupy ground that Zeno helped to excavate. And there is something fitting in the fact that a defender of the doctrine that all is one should himself be remembered primarily for many small, sharp arguments. The one, as Parmenides conceived it, is beyond motion and plurality. Zeno, operating within the world of plurality, uses its very multiplicity of assumptions and intuitions to undermine itself. In doing so, he becomes a strange kind of dialectical warrior, fighting in the arena of the many on behalf of the one, using many blades of reasoning to cut down belief in the reality of many things. There is another angle from which to view Zeno's project, one that connects him to a broader shift in Greek culture. In the generation before him, public life had been dominated by poets, lawgivers, and statesmen whose authority often rested on memory, charisma, and tradition. By Zeno's time, a new type of figure was emerging, the professional arguer, the person whose influence came from an ability to win disputes in assembly and law court. The sophists would soon make a trade of this, traveling from city to city, teaching young men how to speak persuasively on both sides of any issue. Zeno is not a sophist in that mercenary sense, but he shares with them a sense that argument itself is a weapon and a craft. His training, though, is anchored not in the rough and tumble of democratic Athens, but in the severe doctrine of Elia, where a sophist might be content to show that any claim can be made to look plausible. Zeno has a more targeted agenda. He wants to show that certain very widespread assumptions about the many and about motion cannot even be coherently formulated. That difference of aim marks the gap between a merely rhetorical use as paradox and Zeno's more principled deployment. He is not interested in dazzling an audience with cerebral tricks. He is interested in defending, by indirect means, the most austere metaphysical thesis of his time. It is also worth noticing how bodily his examples are. There is no abstraction for its own sake in his choice of images. A race, a runner, a tortoise, an arrow in flight. These are drawn from athletic and martial life, domains that ordinary Greeks would take seriously. In a world where the city's honor could depend on the speed of its runners or the accuracy of its archers, Zeno invites citizens to look at these very sources of pride and see something puzzling. The message, implicit rather than preached, is that even the most accomplished human activities stand on conceptual ground we do not fully understand. One can imagine, in some Eleatic symposium, the younger Zeno presenting his paradoxes as a kind of intellectual sport, but sport of a telling kind. Instead of reciting poetry or showing off feats of memory, he demonstrates how quickly apparently simple convictions fall into confusion under question. This kind of
performance would have had a dual effect. It would have enhanced his personal reputation for cleverness, certainly. More importantly, it would have trained those present to feel a kind of suspicion toward unexamined beliefs. In that, Zeno is closer to the later Socratic ethos than it might first appear. Socrates will go into the marketplace and show that artisans, generals, and poets cannot clearly state what courage or justice is. Zeno does something similar for motion, plurality, and space. If we extend our time horizon still further, Zeno's name becomes attached not only to technical debates, but to a certain mood, the recognition that human reason is capable of getting tangled in its own nets. Kant, many centuries later, will speak of antinomies, pairs of arguments about the world, such as whether it has a beginning in time or stretches back infinitely, that seem equally strong and yet cannot both be true. He regarded these as signs of reason overstepping the proper bounds of experience. Zeno's paradoxes are, in an earlier idiom, antinomies of motion and plurality. They show that when we stretch certain ideas, like divisibility and succession, beyond a certain point, they begin to contradict themselves. Whether one takes this as evidence that reality is paradoxical, we are then our concepts need revision. The effect is the same. naive confidence in our categories is shaken. Modern physics and mathematics have, to an extent, domesticated some of Zeno's beasts. We can write series on a page and show how infinite sums can converge. We can define limits with epsilon-delta rigor. We can model continuous functions that capture motion without requiring an object to visit infinitely many discrete points one by one. But even within these frameworks, questions remain that feel very much in Zeno's spirit. Does spacetime, at the smallest scales, consist of discrete quanta, or is it truly continuous? If there is a smallest meaningful unit of length or time, how does motion look between those grains? If there is not, are we committed to an actual infinity of subdivisions after all? Seen from that angle, Zeno's puzzles are not relics we have outgrown, but early probes into fault lines that we are still mapping. They remind us that any picture we draw of the world, points on a line, grains on a lattice, fields spread over a continuum, is just that, a picture, vulnerable to questioning. The Eleatic demand that our pictures be free of contradiction has not gone away. It lives on in the physicists' drive for a unified theory and the mathematicians' insistence on consistency. For your listeners, Zeno can thus be presented as both a historical figure and a perennial voice in our own heads. Whenever we feel that uneasy jolt, when a simple situation throws up a question that we cannot easily answer, we are in his territory. Whenever we catch ourselves saying, "Of course it works," and then realize we cannot actually say how without hand-waving, Zeno's ghost is tugging at our sleeve. He is the reminder that understanding is not the same as familiarity, and that explanation is not the same as repetition of the obvious. And finally, there is a human dimension that prevents Zeno from being merely a symbol of stark logic. Whether or not the stories of his defiance under torture are literally true, they express something about how later generations imagined him, as someone whose commitment to a certain order, logical, political, cosmic, ran so deep that he would rather suffer than betray it. That image, even if semi-legendary, ties together the strands of his legacy. The man who would not let sloppy thinking stand, also, in the storytelling of later ages, would not let sheer force substitute for reason in the affairs of the city. In that sense, the defender of the immobile one becomes paradoxically a model of steadfastness in a moving and often hostile world. To walk away from Zeno's paradoxes is not necessarily to become an Eleatic. Few today, if any, seriously claim that nothing moves and that reality is a motionless, undivided sphere. But to have taken him seriously is to have earned a kind of conceptual adulthood. You can no longer rest comfortably in your assumptions about space, time, and motion. You know that simple pictures, objects moving along a line of points, instants adding up like beads on a string, are not enough. You have seen that beneath even the most ordinary experiences lies a tangle of questions. For Western moral philosophy, that awareness is part of the inheritance. The same mind that questions the obvious about motion can be turned to question the obvious about power, law, happiness, duty. Zeno's work stands near the beginning of a tradition in which nothing is exempt, in principle, from this kind of scrutiny. To live under that tradition is to live with fewer certainties, but also with a deeper respect for the difficulty of being coherent in thought, in theory, and ultimately in life.
Midnight rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else. nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. The horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be, to be. Thank you.